why? Just so many business podcasts out there. How can I possibly know where to begin? Here at Intrepid Business, we are about stripping away all of the usual boring fluff and instead focus on showcasing real people doing real business, achieving amazing things. The ones truly changing the world, the instigators making a dent, the people changing how we do sales and marketing, leading innovation, the people redefining leadership. But who are these people? Why do they do what they do? How do they do what they do? Find out on Intrepid Business. And now, here are your hosts.
Good morning and welcome back to Intrepid Business. I am your host, Todd Schnick. A little different spin on the usual interview that I do on this show. This is a gentleman that I have been following for, I want to say probably about 6 months, give or take. Does some pretty amazing things. He puts out a weekly email that he calls Brain Food that I think, at least as of the writing that I'm seeing here, has about 55,000 subscribers. I'm one of them. I'm sure he can update that number if it has grown, and it likely has. We're going to have an interesting conversation around a number of different things. We're going to talk about wisdom seeking. We're going to talk about the importance of curation. We're going to talk a lot about reading. Yeah, I know you're tired of me talking about reading, but most of you listening to this aren't reading enough, and so I want to talk to today's guest about why that matters and how to do it more effectively. You'll love to hear how this guy dives into a book and what his process is. So be fascinating conversation. Say hello to my guest. His name is Shane Parrish. He's an entrepreneur, author, and wisdom seeker. Shane, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
The pleasure's mine. Thanks for carving out some very valuable minutes. If you are aware of Shane Parrish at all, you know that him giving me 15 minutes is almost priceless with all that he gets done in a week. So it's quite fascinating. So just in case my audience isn't familiar with you, Shane, take a few quick seconds, inform them a bit about you and your background.
So my name is Shane Parrish. I'm the curator or editor behind the blog. It's called the Farnham Street Blog. And it started basically as a result of, you know, a poor experience in my MBA program. We weren't being taught to think critically about things. We're just kind of being taught to regurgitate things. And it kind of dawned on me that that wasn't the way that I wanted to go through life, and there must be a better approach. One of my classmates pointed out Charlie Munger, who had this lattice work of mental models, and you think about things from multiple disciplines and multiple angles, and it really resonated with me right away. And, you know, I've dedicated the past kind of 6 years on the journey of trying to get better at how we think and how we think critically and how we can apply that to daily life.
Shane, is it your opinion? Let me just make the bold declaration here. I think a significant majority of people out in the world in business doing their thing are not thinking critically in a very, very deep, meaningful way. I think they believe that they are, but I think really they're just conscious. I don't know that they're going deep into these things. Why is that so important?
Well, I mean, just take a step back for a second and think about organizational psychology and how most organizations of, you know, 200 people or more kind of work. And you think about the construct for how we make decisions, and we often make decisions in meetings. And so there's usually some sort of analysis prepared for that meeting. And, you know, it's 20 or 30 pages. It gets sent out, you know, if we're lucky, it gets sent out the day before, and, you know, it's 4 o'clock. You get this docket of, you know, 20 to 30 pages that's, you know, somebody put a lot of thought and effort into, contains quite a bit of analysis, but you also have to go pick up the kids, you have to reply to emails, you have all this other stuff to do. So you kind of put it on hold and you think that you're going to do it first thing in the morning, but you get in the first thing in the morning, your inbox is already full. All of a sudden you're at the meeting. So on the way to the meeting, you tend to read the executive summary. You show up at the meeting and, you know, everybody else is in the same boat. So nobody calls anybody on it. And the only person who's probably read the whole document is the person who created it. And everybody's got great sound bites because we put that at the start in the executive summary. And then people don't think critically about it. I mean, it's not that they can't think about it. In large part, it's because we don't have the time. We're so inundated with emails and voicemails and phone calls and meetings that we don't have the time to put into thinking about things in a comprehensive way.
time certainly is a factor. There's no doubt about it. And I want to understand how you get by with a 26-hour week, it seems like, or 26-hour day. But this, the time is certainly a factor. But, yeah, I also think there's some organizations that don't want their team thinking critically because that could stir the pot a bit. I mean, do you think that's a common scenario?
Exactly. So if you think about the incentives of the people in the room, what often happens in the scenario I just described is that the highest paid person's opinion, the hippo, if you will, tends to carry the day. And so there's no incentive to change that. And then everybody in the room wants to be the hippo one day. So their incentive is just to kind of go along, get along, because one day I'm going to be in that seat and I don't want people challenging me. But when you start having critical discussions on facts, that can be uncomfortable. And a lot of leaders, not everyone, but a lot of people that I've witnessed don't actually want to put themselves in a situation where they could be wrong or challenged by, you know, a subordinate. Because they think that ultimately that makes them less valuable when really it makes them more valuable. It's very short-sighted, I think.
Well, I like to say, and I've said for years, that we are all creatives. Now, I don't mean that we paint or write music or write poetry, because if you're in an organization and you have a job and part of your job is to solve problems on behalf of the organization or your customers, well, that's creative work in my opinion. I would like everybody to think of themselves as a creative. But you can't be a creative organization. You certainly can't be an innovative organization if you're not thinking critically, right?
I think that's a large part of it, right? I think it's we all. When you were talking, one thing that struck me is we all kind of curate our own life, and some of us do that unconsciously, and some of us do it consciously. And I think part of Farnham Street is trying to expose people to different things where I can get them to recognize that things are interesting that they never thought were interesting before and be more conscious about what they let into their life in terms of reading and everything else. And through that, I mean, it doesn't have to be this recognition, but we all go through life and we curate each day and we curate each hour. And how we spend our time matters a lot. And I think it's all too often, you know, we don't think about that until we're, you know, near our deathbed or we get struck with a disease that's going to kill us. And then we start thinking about our priorities more consciously. And I know that's a little off topic from the organization point of view, but I think it's just an important reminder that we do own this control and we control our lives. And we have to think about how we spend that time.
Boy, Shane, you know, we're going to talk about curation in a bit, but I haven't really thought of it that we're curating our life, we're curating our day, we're curating the hour that's before us. I'm going to have to think about that a little bit because that's exactly what that's about. When I introduced you and your bio says that you are a wisdom seeker, I'm just slamming the typical employee of a typical organization here today, but I feel like most people out there are not wisdom seekers, right? They're just going through the daily run of life. I feel like you get through high school or college and you think, all right, my job as the wisdom seeker is now done. Do you agree with that? And how do we change that? I want everybody to be insanely curious about what's going on around them, not just for them to do a better job for their employer, but just to live a more interesting life.
Yeah, so the other faucet to Farnham Street is kind of, it's my journey in life about discovery and self-discovery. And it's not necessarily about critical thinking, but it's also about curiosity and learning new things and being exposed to things that I find interesting that, you know, and I'm trying to expose other people to things that they find interesting that they might not have come across in their daily kind of operation. I mean, a lot of people do, they go home and they're comfortable and, you know, they do their job and they do it well. And there's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, I would like to see more people interested in things other than TV or surfing the internet all day. But there's a lot of great stuff out there. And it just seems like we tend to fall into this kind of status quo where we do what's expected of us and we go home, we do our job and then we're tired. So what we do is, you know, we turn on the TV and we put our feet up. I kind of think of wisdom seeking as a process. It's almost like an ecosystem and that ecosystem is always evolving. And I want my place in that ecosystem to, you know, maintain itself at worst or get better. And getting better can be monetary rewards. It can be, you know, meaningful life or other contributions. It doesn't have to be, you know, one particular goal. It's getting better as you define it. And for me, getting better is learning new things and just constantly being exposed to the world that we live in for all of its beauty. And so I've organized my life and structured things along the path that I know that that's what I want to do. And it's just a matter of getting better at how I go about doing it and then eliminating the things from my life that I don't like and being conscious about what I let into my life and what I don't let into my life.
Well, that's just what we talked about. The process you just described is curating your life. Now,
exactly.
Like most other humans on the planet, this past weekend, I dove into House of Cards Season 3. And it's funny, Shane, you're probably similar to me in that when I am consuming somebody else's art, whether it's a television series like House of Cards, or I'm listening to music, or I'm reading someone else's book, or someone else's essay, I almost feel guilty. I'm like, well, why aren't I creating a television series? Why aren't I creating, writing a song, or recording a song, or writing a book, and all that? And I watch these things, and I feel guilty because someone ought to be reading my book and watching my television series. And it's just funny. You're probably similar in that when you're consuming someone else's stuff. Of course, you spend your life consuming other people's stuff. So you probably, it's part of your process. So how do you think we shift the mindset of the person out there who's more about consuming content than necessarily creating? I mean, or maybe a better way to ask the question is, how do we go from consumers of knowledge to, I'm struggling to ask this question. I want people to go away from.
Are we consuming knowledge or are we consuming information? And where do we go from information to knowledge to kind of wisdom? And how does that work? And when you were talking, I was thinking that, you know, that's really interesting. We've never lived in a time where it was easier to kind of get your message out there and to write a book or to write a song and allow people to listen to it in a very frictionless way. You don't have to show up at a concert anymore to hear a song. You can go online and hear an MP3 or a YouTube video, or, you know, you don't have to go to a book publisher in a traditional sense and get an advance and take time off to write a book. You can come home and do that part time. I mean, a lot of authors do that. They have day jobs and then they come home and they write for their passion and they hope that they hit it big one day and get a bestseller and get some sort of literary fame. I guess I don't know. For me, I mean, I don't create a lot in the sense of original content. I try to piece together other people's ideas. I mean, the tagline for the website is mastering the best of what other people have figured out. We live these really short lives, and I don't have time to figure everything out myself, and I don't necessarily want to figure everything out myself. If I can learn from the mistakes of other people or the wisdom of other people, that's amazing, because I mean, I make enough mistakes myself that as long as I'm learning from them, I think that that's incredibly important. But if I learn from other people, then I'm probably going to get a little bit ahead in life, right? And again, that comes back to how you think about what you want out of life and how you structure your life to achieve those goals.
Yeah, that's great stuff. Let's talk about curation. Now, I named my company Intrepid many years ago because when I launched the company, I was really largely a marketing strategist. And so the gist of what I was trying to do was to help organizations be much more bold and fearless in their marketing approach. And so many, many years later, I still operate around that theme of being intrepid. And so when I put out my newsletter, where I curate some interesting new tools, interesting stories, interesting videos, oftentimes there's meant to be a subliminal push to say, here's an example of someone being intrepid. And it's a way that I can kind of expose my audience to some intrepid ideas. But that's one of the goals of curation, right, is to organize ideas and knowledge around a theme and educate and bring awareness to that to an audience. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. So, I mean, setting the context and structure of the piece and highlighting what you think is valuable in that sense, I think that those are all important aspects of curation. Google curates for us when we search for a term, right? It's a very algorithmic, contextless, kind of cold curation. And then you have people. And I think that, you know, there's the search bubble, which, you know, Google is giving the argument that Google is giving you more of what you want. And so you're being less exposed to other things, including serendipity. And, you know, you're coming across less and less things that you would have normally come across. Like when you used to read the newspaper in physical format, you would come across articles that you didn't agree with or stories that you never would have clicked on, but you ended up falling in love with. And I think the role of the personal curator as we go forward, if you can establish trust with an audience, I think that's incredibly important moving forward, because we need some sort of counterbalance to the algorithmic curation to expose people to new ideas and new ways of thinking, and setting the context for how those ideas are presented and where they fit in the broader world, and how walking along the transformation with people from information to knowledge, kind of to wisdom.
I think the process of curating content such as that is a very beneficial one to the curator, him or herself. So there's real value in just the exercise, I think. And you find that as you're going about your week, your mind is more open to look for other things that you could say, wow, that could fit nicely and would be of real interest and perhaps real value to my audience. I mean, it just opens your mind, just the mere act of doing it. But there's a real value to the audience, too. I mean, I think it's a very critical business development strategy. I think if you have an audience that you're trying to, let's be honest, you're trying to sell them, but you're also trying to move them and educate them and build up that trust, as you suggest, I think you can achieve all of that with a curation strategy, yeah?
Yeah, totally. I mean, so in addition to kind of what you said with move people, it's, I think, you know, from my point of view, I want to be an indispensable part of people's lives as they go through life and they grow in life. And I want to be one of the most meaningful things that appear. You know, people are trusting curators with their time. And, you know, the time is, for a lot of people, it's the most valuable thing we have. It's more valuable than money. And to give me time every week in your inbox, I need to work hard to earn that. And I need to set the journey with me, right, in terms of my curiosity goes all over the place. So it's a matter of, you know, sometimes that's eclectic and sometimes I get caught up on things like everybody else. I mean, we're all human. But the goal is to expose you to things that you wouldn't normally come across, in my sense, that you're really interested and passionate about, and then connect it back to something we already know or something that we've already talked about. So that the longer you read Farnham Street or Brain Food, the more you're equipped, I mean, from a practical point of view, you're equipped to handle different problems and you're equipped to operate in uncertainty. And you remember, oh, I know a strategy to deal with that, or I know a different way to think about this perspective. And so I get this all the time. People read Farnham Street for a day or two and they're like, oh, you know, I didn't like the post, so I didn't subscribe, but then my friend kind of nudged me to it, so I started reading it for a week, and I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting. And then I read it for a month, and I realized it's totally invaluable, and now I'm hooked because it's all over the map, and it's all different things, and you never know when those things are going to be relevant into your life. And, you know, a lot of it is me being vulnerable with people, too, and sharing my personal learning experiences. I mean, I shared one last year about being you know, friendship. Part of friendship is letting your friends be there for you. And I had never thought about it in that way before. I was always the friend that people would call and they could rely on me no matter what the situation was. But I was never the one to call anybody else and say, hey, I need you. And, you know, various things happened in my life. And I realized that, you know, part of being an amazing friend and growing as a friend is actually letting your friends be there for you.
Yeah,
and so part of that curation is my journey as well. And it's this kind of intermixing of all of these things and then connecting them back to these principles that seem to endure over time. And I think that's kind of how the framework that I approach it with. And I'm sure you have similar thoughts.
Oh, of course. And that's a lovely explanation of the import of the trust building element of curation. But let's talk about our story, you and me. So a mutual reader of your Brain Food about probably summer of 2014 kept forwarding me the Sunday morning email, and I thought, oh, this looks interesting, and the content spoke to me, and so I became a subscriber. And then over those last several months, seeing Shane Parrish in my inbox every Sunday with really good information, good content, I did develop this trust with you that I could always rely on you to provide me really valuable information, stuff that would help and serve me, and continued to deepen that relationship with you through the inbox, to the point where I got interested enough in inviting you to be a guest on the show, right? So you can see the progression of how this thing works, and so apply that basic timeline of how you get connected by the referral likely of somebody else who's already been affected by it. And then that relationship grows and trust develops. It leads to a much more personal and meaningful and impactful interaction like we're doing right now as we record this. And that's the lesson I want, that same relationship can be built with your audience and whatever you're trying to develop in terms of a relationship with that person, whether it's a business opportunity or not. So, all right, well, the final subject I want to talk about is reading. You obviously read an awful lot. Now, I've been joking with you all throughout the broadcast that you have seemed to have found the 26-hour day, but the fact remains you have the same amount of hours in the day that we all have, and you make effective use of it. I guess what I'd love for you to talk about is really two things, and it goes back to our conversation of I wish there was more wisdom seekers in the world. Mm. But why is reading so valuable? Why is reading so important? And how do you do it? You have a really interesting process. You don't just open up a book and read it and throw it away. You go through it. You have a very articulate process of how you go through a book. Talk about that.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, reading is just the key to different exposures, and it's only one form of media. I consume video, I consume documentaries, and I mean, I'm not crazy. I have a Netflix subscription and everything like that. And video is just kind of, reading is one way that we can get. A lot of people have dealt with the same problems that we're dealing with today in a different time, in a different format, and they've articulated those thoughts in detail and in depth, and that information is available and it's out there. We just have to find it. And I think that a lot of what I read, I'm trying to read things increasingly. I mean, that are timeless instead of things that come and go. I mean, I caught myself on the pop psychology bandwagon a few years ago, and you know, I just kept keeping up to date with the latest and latest pop sci books, and It just wasn't doing it for me. So I've kind of gone back, and you know, Nassim Taleb has the concept of the Lindy effect, which is, you know, the longer something's been around, the more valuable it is from a consumption point of view. So going back and reading a lot of the works that got me hooked on Stoic philosophy, and I mean, a lot of that stuff could have been written yesterday, and it's just so timeless and so representative of the culture that we're in today. And it helps me, and it helps me live a meaningful life. And it's important. And then, so how do I go about reading that stuff? Well, you know, I have different processes for different types of books, and certain books I read over and over again, and certain books I read once. And generally what I'm doing is I'm reading a physical copy of the book. I'm taking notes in not only the book itself, but also in the front cover about you know, possible posts or connections to other ideas or the author's kind of structure in terms of argumentation or vocabulary that I'm getting hooked up on. And if you're learning about a new subject, I mean, the best way to kind of dive in is to buy five or six different books by different authors and start translating the different vocabularies that each one of them have into your own vocabulary. And then you develop an understanding, at some level anyway, of what's happening in the dynamics at play. And then hopefully you can apply that into your life. But when I'm done reading a book, I kind of just put it on my desk for a week or so, generally speaking, not always. And then I go back to it and I read all the marginalia I wrote, all the underlines, all the highlights. And then I kind of determine at the point where to go. So often, I mean, this is going to sound horrible, but you know, I'll take an X-Acto knife out and scan pages into my computer, into Evernote, or I'll buy a Kindle copy if I really like the book, and I'll transfer my highlights into the Kindle copy, which is a very labor-intensive kind of thing to do. But I don't have the space for, you know, 8,000 or so physical books. And I get sent a lot of books too. And so I end up donating a lot to the local elementary school book drive or whatever is on the go. But I think that for me, reading is just part of my life. I mean, Charlie Munger said it best that, you know, he said he's known no smart people who didn't read a lot. And I think that I don't get caught up. Like, I try not to read on the Kindle because it's so easy to go into Twitter, and it's so easy to go into YouTube, and it's so easy to check my email. But with a physical book, I have to force myself to be present. And, you know, at first that was pretty hard. And it can be, too. If I go on a very, you know, high internet diet, so to speak, then going back to a physical book can be hard. But I find the rewards are incredibly beneficial in terms of I get out of what we were talking about earlier and reading the executive summary. And I know that there's more meat to something. And I know that I need to think about it, and I know that I need the space, and I know that I need to kind of apply the structuring of content and identifying the argument, and just logically how I process that information is totally different than when I'm reading it on a Kindle. So I think that that helps me remember that, you know, that there's a big world out there. Books are, you know, I think of articles, actually, I don't know who I got this from, but I think of articles as the tip of the iceberg, and books is kind of like what's beneath the surface. And so we get these short articles on the internet, and often they're designed to get our attention, and they're designed just to get us to click, and nobody really cares whether we liked it or not. But in a book, you have this depth of thinking that you don't get in most of these articles, and you can find them online. They're just incredibly hard to find. And I love that. I mean, something about that appeals to me. Something about somebody putting that much time and thought and effort and craftsmanship into a book, I don't know, it's really cool versus, you know, the you know, 20 minutes it takes to write a blog post that, you know, I got to write another one in 10 minutes. And I don't know, maybe that's a little bit nostalgic, but.
Well, I have nothing to add to that. That was great stuff. Shane, what do you say to the guy who says, Shane, yeah, it's all fine. I get it. I just don't have the time. How do you address that with them?
Well, we all have the same amount of time, right? And we go back to the point about curating your life. You have priorities. And whether you're conscious of them or you're unconscious of them, you have the same amount of time as everybody else. And I think that one of the best ways to live is to kind of live backwards. And by that, I mean, what do I want to do in life and how do I do that? And if you're spending your time in a way that's not conducive for that, and everybody makes their own choices. I'm not here to advocate that my approach is better for anybody else. I mean, it's the approach that works for me, and it's the approach that you know, I love, and I hope that other people love it, and I expose them to it, and it seems to gravitate with a lot of people, because it seems like there's not a lot of meaning anymore, and we're getting diluted with all of this noise, and then you find an approach, you know, similar to mine or somebody else's, and you think, wow, you know, I like that a little bit better, and then you start doing it, and you find that your life opens up these doors that you thought were closed or you never knew existed. And so just to summarize, I mean, it's all about priorities. You need to know what's important in your life. And I think that we're just so busy that it comes back to that again. We're so busy that we actually don't think about how we're living, what we're prioritizing, and how we're spending our time. I mean, I think it would be amazing if everybody took one day out of the year in December and just literally went to a spa or something or a bath or whatever, and just thought about, like, how did I spend my time this year? How do I want to spend it next year? And how can I structure my life in a way that moves me towards those goals? It doesn't have to be cold turkey. You don't have to quit anything, but maybe you stop consuming newspapers because you're not getting any value out of them. Maybe you just challenge the status quo of your day-to-day and you work a little bit better towards nudging yourself to where you want to be, or exposing yourself to something you want to be exposed to, or learning a new skill like playing the guitar. And you find a way to make time for that because it's a priority in your life.
Great stuff. Shane, we're out of time. Before I let you go, where can people go to dive into?
Thank you very much, Todd. I appreciate the time.
Yeah. Where can people go to get information on Farnham Street, and where can they get brain food?
So on Twitter, it's at Farnham Street, F-A-R-N-A-M Street, S-T-R-E-E-T. On the internet, it's farnhamstreetblog.com, F-A-R-N-A-M streetblog.com. And you can just click on the newsletter link and you can sign up.
All right.
Over, I think we have over 150 people a day signing up now. So.
That's great stuff. Well, and I'm not surprised to hear that. Shane Parrish, entrepreneur, author, and wisdom seeker. Shane, as I suspected, cool conversation. Thanks for making time.
Thanks a lot, Todd. I appreciate that.
All right. Well, that wraps this broadcast. On behalf of my guest, Shane Parrish, I'm Todd Schnick. We'll see you soon on Intrepid Business.